last few days to allow the committee to process the GPF bill, amendment bill. I think so far, because of our cooperation, we've been able to succeed in pulling it together within a very short space of time. I must congratulate you for that and for the cooperation amongst various parties within the committee. Today we are going to take two presentations. The first one is a briefing by National Treasury. I'm not sure as to whether this is the first one. This is the second one. So why do you put them this way? Oh, yes. Yeah, no. The first one, the report back by SARS on the tax administration bill. The commissioner is here and his team. And we also want to, on behalf of the committee, let me welcome the stakeholders that have always been part and parcel of this process. Professor, sometimes I think you are from National Treasury or SARS. But welcome. Commissioner Makhashul, we are in your hands. I must also indicate to honorable members that, as you know, that the parliament has got other activities outside the parliament, Bloemfontein to be specific. And there are a number of committee members who are traveling to that part of the country. We try to be as short as possible in terms of these interactions today. Not because we don't value the presentation. I think we've been with this important issues before us for quite some time. So it is nothing new altogether, except probably the last presentation that we're going to get later on after tea. Yes, I thought I should just make that point, or put that point across, that we should try to allow those who are going to travel safely. Thank you. Commissioner?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and the members of the Standing Committee. Chair, let me first start by announcing that you know, this filing season is going very well, Chair. We have, with 8 weeks remaining of the filing season, we've already received 2 million returns and from good South Africans. So I wanted to take this opportunity just to thank them for knocking our doors down to file. It shows that South Africans are starting to develop a very good culture of compliance. And I'm sure when I say South Africans, Honorable Chair, I'm talking about even people in this room, yes, yeah. Chair, thanks for giving us this opportunity to brief you on the SARS response to the public comments on the tax administration bill. Chair, with the things that have been handed through to you, there's the official detailed response document. As you can see, Chair, it's even bigger than the bill itself. So there's a lot of work that has gone into it, and then it's been tabled for your availability, Chair. Honorable members, it's been a long process so far. It's been such a long process, but also a process that has been recognized as probably the most thorough that any bill has followed, particularly bills that have gone through this committee. This process included the release of 2 draft bills for public comments, Chair. There were workshops internally and external with external stakeholders and other government departments. And this period of consultation and workshop, Chair, went over a period of 2 years. So it's not the first time that, you know, this year alone that we have been confronted with this bill. Thereafter, Chair, Cabinet approved the bill in September 2010, and the bill was introduced in the National Assembly on the 23rd of June 2011. And then we, as SARS, formally briefed this committee before the formal briefing. We had an informal briefing, as you know, Chair. But formally we briefed the committee on the 2nd of August 2011 in a meeting that was held in Pretoria. And then public responses as well as opinions by independent council chair on the constitutionality of the bill was offered and was presented at the hearings that was held on the 16th and the 17th of August 2011. During this public hearings, Chair, many commentators, some of them are here in the room, expressed their appreciation for the extensive consultation approach that we as SARS have adopted in drafting this bill. However, of course, there were some presenters during the hearings, honorable members, that expressed a view that and raised concerns during the commentary and consultation process, which some of them we strongly disagree with, and I will address those in this presentation, Chair. We will be very short, Chair, as you have hinted that this is these issues that you are dealing with, we have really dealt with them through the consultation quite thoroughly. But Chair, I need to point out that you know, there's been a significant consultation and significant changes have happened throughout these 2 years. And there are a few changes that we have made to the original bill in the last 2 years based on the comments and the commentary that was made by this committee and the public. Some of those, Chair, was the introduction of the tax ombud was a direct response to a comment. If you remember the original bill, did not have a provision for a tax ombud. And the fact that now we have a tax ombud, you know, it's proof enough that we have listened and we have responded quite positively. We have also removed advance notice for people that are leaving South Africa. So that was also a direct response to the comments that were made by the public. Limitations of information request to available records was also one of the concessions that were made. Reasonable specification, specificity. Chair, I'm a morolong. Sometimes I better. Specificity, limitation on information request. Inquiry, the other concession that was made, Chair, was the inquiry must be approved by a judge or a privileged officer, presiding officer, that their decisions must be reviewable. Protections of legal professions privileged during seizure, although there were other comments which I will touch on where accountants wanted this privilege of professionalism should be extended to them. I'll respond to that as a point in a minute. The right to claim damages that arise from a search and seizure that is not properly constituted, you know, was introduced as a response to some of the comments that were made by the public. Reportable arrangements failure is no longer an offense. It's also part of the concessions that we have made. Estimated assessments, Chair, and the fact that if these estimates are supposed to stick, the burden of proof should lie with SARS. It's also an improvement on the bill that we introduced. Remittance interest neutrality and remittance of interest also was introduced. Security for audited refunds, and we also introduced, Chair, a permanent voluntary disclosure program rather than a once-off disclosure program. And we have also, I will talk more to the the percentage, the scale, you know, the remittance scale of percentages that accompany the VDP. We have changed it slightly to make people to take up the voluntary disclosure program far more better than the original table that was presented in the bill. So, Chair, I went through this just to say, if you think after this public comment that we have not responded quite comprehensively, I was just pointing out that through the 2 years, there's been lots of concessions and changes and accommodations that have been made throughout the process of consultation. So, Chair, let me turn now to the public hearing comments and start with the ones that we want to recommend the committee to consider not to adopt. Chair, let me begin with the two key areas where SAS recommends that the committee not accept the proposals by the commentators, so that we can get the bad news out of the way and deal with the good news. The first one, Chair, is the legal profession privilege. As you know, Chair, many commentators, particularly accounted representative bodies, and some of them are here today, propose that the bill should extend statutory legal privilege to apply to tax advice provided by tax practitioners who are not lawyers. It is recommended that the comment be held over, Chair, and that's our recommendation, that this comment be held over for consideration together with the future regulation of tax practitioners, which will be coming to the committee later. You cannot, Chair, have tax practitioners who are not lawyers and are currently not regulated by law or the courts, as is the case with the legal profession, for them to have a privilege because they are unregulated. And you know, Chair, that there are lots of these fly-by-night tax advisors who are presently not regulated, and to give them professional privilege would really be, promoting rogue business doing in our country. So we are recommending that there is a bill that is coming forward, Chair, which is called the Regulation of Tax Practitioners Bill. And after that, if the controls and the regulations around tax practitioners is strong enough to equal the regulations of legal professionals, then a consideration and an amendment can be looked at to accommodate them. But it's also fair to mention, Chair, that internationally a number of concerns have been raised with extending this privilege to non-lawyers. For example, if you take Australia, a review paper on this issue pointed out the potential for delay and abuse. They called it the floodgate argument for other professionals and the potential for difficulties in the international and interagency context. Because if we talk about exchange of tax information and exchange of tax practices across the world, then we have to have some form of a consistency. So Australia is already dealing with the issue of the legal professions privilege. The second one, Chair, that we don't recommend that you consider is warrantless search and seizure. Most of the commentators, Chair, recognize that SAS needs this power. I think they prefaced all their comments, without exception, Chair, to the fact that there is a need for a warrantless search and seizure by SAS. But they queried, Chair, its constitutionality and in its current form, and they proposed additional checks and balances, such as that only the commissioner, myself, Chair, may give prior approval of such a process or subsequent approval by a judge before SAS may use the information seized in a warrantless search and seizure. So they're saying we need the warrantless search and seizure, but the conditions around this warrantless search and seizure, they are concerned that they might be unconstitutional. as the committee has had chair from two of the most recognized and respected constitutional counsel in this country, that they are of the opinion, this expects, that the provision is constitutional in its current form, and that no additional checks and balances are required to render it more constitutional. You cannot be as constitutional as you are constitutional. So the experts, Chair, were very clear and unanimous on their view that as the current bill stands, it has enough checks and balances in its current form to render the bill constitutional. They have come to the in front of the committee to present their opinions. In the context of the suggested subsequent approval by a judge, the Cape Town Bar also pointed out that this is unnecessary as an aggrieved taxpayer has immediate access anyway to contest any of the warrantless search and seizure in a higher court immediately without having, he's got access to higher courts to contest this thing. So his immediate access is just like that. If you think the warrantless search and seizure is not being executed properly or is unconstitutional or whatever, immediately the aggrieved have access to the higher courts. And that was set by the Cape Town Bar. So, Chair, those are the so-called bad news, but I think they are not bad news. They are good news, actually, because real thorough work has been done. Now, let me come to the significant changes that we agree with the commentators that needs to be introduced to improve this bill. From the public hearing, Chair, the good news is that there are significant areas where we as SAS agree that the legislation can be improved. The slide that is slide number 5 in front of you, there, Chair, reflects the proposed significant changes to the bill. I will address what I believe to be the most important issues, Chair, and then my comrade and colleague in arms here next to me, Franz Tomasek, Chair, will take you through the real nuance and all the stuff, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, you know, of this bill, Chair. You know, the bill is this thick, Chair, and the response is this thick, so he knows it backwards. So let me just concentrate just on the two or three big concessions to improve the bill, Chair, that we recommend for your consideration. So the areas for proposed changes, Chair, are the following. When it comes to the tax ombuds staff, we agree with the commentators that the secondment of SARS employees to the tax ombuds office is a practical matter, which will ensure that staff are knowledgeable about tax and SARS internal processes and will simplify the administration of secrecy around tax payers' affairs. So the recommendation to say staff from the ombuds, for matter of practical administrative efficiency, we recommend that they should come from SARS, because the complaints to the ombuds would be about the administrative failure of SARS. So if you have people who don't understand the administrative processes of SARS, it will take a little bit of time for them to be fully competent and efficient in doing their job. So that's the first thing, and I think some commentators agree with us on those bases. However, it is recommended, Chair, that the secondment of this staff be at the instance of the tax ombuds. And he will do that, or she will do that, in consultation with the Commissioner of SARS. So it will be the tax ombud who will be consulting with us and say, I want that staff, I don't want this one. And then he or she, Chair, we recommend, or then will come and consult with SAS and the commissioner on that issue. Currently, the bill proposes that the commissioner seconds to the tax ombud after consultation of the ombud. So the changes that we are proposing, Chair, to make it clear that the tax ombud, who is independent from SAS, drives the staff selection process. So it will not be after consultation, but in consultation of the tax ombud. So we'll amend and we recommend that we change the wording to reflect the fact that the selection process is run by the tax ombuds, not by SAS. Chair, the other recommendation was the reporting of the tax ombud. The annual report currently only requires a summary of at least 10 of the most serious issues encountered by taxpayers, by the ombuds. The tax ombud also has the mandate to identify systemic and emerging issues, for example, those related to service matters and service failures, Chair. It is therefore recommended that the tax ombud's annual report must also include these issues, you know, the 10 most serious issues, and these issues in order to make sure that we improve the oversight of the committee and parliament on the tax ombuds. And we also are recommending, Chair, that the Minister of Finance table the tax ombuds annual report in parliament officially to this committee, as this will enhance parliamentary oversight, including by this committee, over the administration of tax by SAS. So we agree with the recommendation that the report of the tax ombuds, rather than just ending with the Minister of Finance officially tables the report of the ombuds for oversight and deliberation by the parliamentary committees. Chair, there are other responses, as I mentioned, that would be dealt with by France, but let me just touch on a few. But the tax ombuds, the two issues on the tax ombuds are the real big concessions that we believe we recommend the committee considers. And then you will speak to the ones that are on the slide 6 there, Chair, which is records retained for audit, inspections, interview at SAS offices that will be limited to taxpayers' affairs, and he will also explain the limitations of the 200-kilometer rule, third-party liability, and then, as I mentioned earlier, Chair, that the penalty, percentage-based penalties, we have reviewed it also, particularly also relating to the voluntary disclosure program. He will talk more on those details and the understatement of penalty. So, Mr. Tomasek will take over from me here, sir. So let me thank you, Chair, for the opportunity for us to interact with the committee on the bill. As I said, it will be very short, Chair. We've been very instructive on the fact that we mustn't repeat stuff that we have spoken to about. And I hope Mr. Tomasek would follow suit. He can talk, Chair.
Yeah, well, I see, Commissioner, you have decided to withdraw his... his title to qualify for non-statutory forces pension. So I was beginning to be worried that this act or this bill was being pushed by yourself.
Let me also thank the commentators for all their comments and their extremely professional and constructive interaction throughout this bill. You know that there are many bills that are going through Parliament where, you know, people have not been able to talk across to each other. I think for the commentators and the public, in their interaction on this bill, Chair, it's been extremely exemplary in our view in resolving all the differences that were there. So I want to really thank them for their commitment to coming out of the best bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. I'll try and be quite brief on this. The One of the concerns that was raised by commentators was that prescription for retention of records would extend if an audit is in progress. And the concern was, well, the person needs to be aware of the fact that the audit is in progress in order to know that they should be retaining the records for a longer period. That makes sense, so we're proposing or recommending that that particular change be made. There were some concerns around the ability of SARS to inspect premises, and we're suggesting here that that be retained, but that it be further restricted, so that it is absolutely clear that what we're dealing with here are business premises, so that we're not dealing with a person's own home. So there's a recommended change to give effect to that. Interviews at SARS offices, there were some concerns here about why a third party should be called to be interviewed at a SARS office to talk about a taxpayer's own taxpayer-specific affairs. That makes sense. So that particular ability to require someone to come in for an interview is now restricted to the taxpayer personally. And then there was a question of the practicalities of this. I mean, how far do you have to travel to make this happen? What we're suggesting here is that the taxpayer be able to decline the requirement to come in for an interview based on the travel distance involved. And what's being proposed is that the commissioner set out some parameters. So obviously the bigger the case, the more likely it is and the more reasonable it is that you should be prepared to travel a significant distance. But if it's only a small amount, then a shorter distance would be reasonable. Jeopardy assessments, these are the assessments that are issued where tax collection is in jeopardy. They're in advance of when an assessment would normally be issued. That is quite an unusual power, but it is a development of an existing power that exists in the Income Tax Act. There were some concerns around this one, so the recommendation here is that the Commissioner approve that a jeopardy assessment be issued, because it should be quite an unusual event. And equally, there were some concerns about who gets to prove whether it is reasonable that a jeopardy assessment was issued in advance of the normal date, and we're recommending that SARS, in fact, bear the burden of proof that that was reasonable. Some questions around third-party liability. That's where something's happened and the third party is now being held liable for a tax debt. There was a question of, you know, how does the third party get to know? Do they get an opportunity to make representations to SARS to convince us that they should not be held liable? Again, reasonable suggestion. We're recommending that prior opportunity be granted, but we should bear in mind that sometimes we're going to be dealing with some fairly hardcore non-compliant people here. There's a reason why you're having to hold the third party liable, because the company, for example, is what is known as a Phoenix company, say, which is just created to get refunds from SARS and then disappears, and then business is reborn to do the same thing again a bit later. So there may be circumstances where that is not possible, and there the recommendation is that as soon as practically possible, the person be allowed to make representations. And then also, there's a recommendation that be clarified that the third party has exactly the same rights to contest as the original taxpayer would have had. We thought that was implicit, but people were concerned, so we're suggesting it be made explicit. Then some quite important ones. The bill brings percentage-based penalties into a consistent framework with administrative penalties. Part of the side effect of that was that a cap of 2,000 Rand was placed on the remittance. Now, a percentage-based penalty by its nature doesn't have a cap. The administrative penalties all do have a cap. They get to a point and stop. So just as the penalty does not have a cap, we're recommending that the ability to waive the penalty also not have a cap. So that makes logical sense, so a recommendation from our side and an acceptance of a comment that was made. And then the point that the Commissioner was mentioning a little earlier, and this is around the substantial understatement penalty. Currently the way it's phrased, it could actually apply to quite small taxpayers. So we're recommending that it be made clear that it only applies to large taxpayers. And what we're talking about here is where the understatement is in excess of the greater of 1 million rand or 5% of tax properly chargeable. So we are talking about, so this is just the understatement, must be over 1 million. that makes it very clear. And there was a question about, well, what happens if you took a reasonable position? Should you still be hit with a substantial understatement penalty? And the response here is the ability to waive that penalty does make sense, but it should be under fairly strict conditions, given that we're now talking about the largest taxpayers in very large amounts. And so the recommendation here is that there is a potential to waive the substantial understatement penalty, but only if there was full disclosure to SARS and if there was a well-founded opinion that the taxpayer holds that that was more likely than not to succeed. And then if those conditions are in place, then the substantial understatement penalty could be waived or reduced. I should add one additional point here, which actually isn't on the slide, and this talks to the table and the voluntary disclosure program. It's quite an important point which the Commissioner raised earlier. We would obviously like people to come forward in terms of voluntary disclosure, but the way the table is currently structured, it is only for substantial understatements that there will be no penalty for coming forward voluntarily. In other cases, there is a reduced penalty, but there is still a penalty. What we're proposing on page 61 of the response document is a revision of the table for voluntary disclosures before an audit commences, so that, in fact, except in the most serious cases, there is no penalty when you come forward voluntarily, and even in the most serious cases, there is a relatively small penalty, and that's 5% and 10%. So we think that would make the voluntary disclosure program going into the future a much more attractive one for people who wish to come clean before we come and knock on their doors. Commissioner Chair, that is it from my side. I hope I've kept it as short as you would like me to.
Unlike you. Honourable members, or from the side of the Commissioner, is there any other thing that you want to add before we... Nothing? Kosi, you fine? Katinga?
Just on the way forward, what we propose, the amendments that we propose to the committee, can be in a document where you can actually see the changes we propose. And if the committee then accepts them, we can draft the, I think, what you call the ABLE process going from here on. We actually need the input of the commission on this, of the committee on this.
Not too far. Okay. Honorable Van Rooyen, you'll be followed by Honorable Madamini. Dr. George. Honorable Natim. Enoch Mutetwa, Nyambul. And then you'll be followed by Honorable Gorenwolf, in that order. General?
Thank you very much, Chair, and let me start by welcoming the response from SARS. Chair, in the spirit and the letter of the Ombuds office being independent, I just wanted to confirm my understanding. The Commissioner said at the instance of the Ombuds, the selection of SARS officials will be conducted, just to be part of the Ombuds office. Now, I'm not sure if I'm at the same level of understanding by interpreting this to mean when it's necessary, when deemed necessary by the Ombud. I mean, the officials from SARS will then be co-opted, to serve in his or her office. I'm asking this, Chair, because I'm contesting the submission made by the Commissioner that In fact, it's an assumption that only people from SARS or all those only people that are in the employ of SARS are conversant with tax matters. I'm content with that particular submission because I think that assumption is not appropriately premised, because there are people who, of course, might be having the know-how of SARS affairs who are not in the employ of SARS. So in that way, we can't compare or impose a condition on the Umbas, I mean, to establish, to consider, I mean, the commencement of the office by taking people from SARS, I mean, as the foundation of the Umbas office. So as a result, I don't agree that, in fact, I don't even see the essence of why are we emphasizing on this point, because the Umbas office must be at liberty, I mean, to make a determination on the composition of the said office. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm laughing because my point is almost like Honorable Van Rooyen, but in a very different angle. I just need a clarity. We will second, the SARS will do the secondment, right? And then who are these staff that would be selected by the tax lombard? Who are they? Because when you do the selection, that's when it's like you're interviewing, you put a criteria of who needs to be appointed, But now there is secondment, so which means there will be other personnel that will be selected by the tax lombard. If you can just clarify for me, who are those? Is it going to be maybe the senior management, the mid management within the tax lombard, and then the secondment coming from SARS, at what level, what categories that are, because of the selection that you've put in, that will be driven by the tax lombard, then it makes a bit of the confusion. Now, coming to the proposal by SARS that where the recommendations that came from the commentators, some of them the SARS is uncomfortable with it. That is now the legal professional privilege. I agree that let us hold this up. Let us try and hold it on, and consider and do the consideration together with the future regulation of the tax practitioners. I agree with that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much to SARS for your feedback. Chairperson, this is a very comprehensive bill. We know that. So I don't think there's any need for us to rush through the process. Now, we did receive this document, but we only got it this morning. And there's a lot of things in there that I think I certainly would like to have a much closer look at. But anyway, also I wanted to point out that there's a lot of noise and distrust out there regarding this bill. But I do think we are making progress, and also I don't think there's any need for anybody to get hysterical about it. But there is quite a lot of, it seems, hysteria about a couple of things in this bill. There were four areas, really, that I was very concerned about. The first one was the constitutionality of the search and seizure without warrant. Now, we did receive feedback from advocates on the constitutionality, and that was very useful, thank you. But there was also the issue that we raised about the balance that was needed. So, for example, there was discussion on if there's a search and seizure on a regular basis or whatever, there would be some way that we would be able to identify whether something was going wrong. So, in other words, that, you know, there's so much of this search and seizure without warrant happening, this alerts you to some kind of a problem. And I'm just wondering how that balance is achieved. Maybe it's in here, but I can't seem to find it. Then on the issue of the protection of whistleblowers within SARS, I do know that information needs to be protected. Obviously, taxpayers' information is confidential and secret. But there are instances where you might have a situation where a staff member within SARS has a major problem with SARS and needs to blow a whistle of some kind. I think we must make sure that they can do that. That's a good way and good governance, and to make sure that governance is rigorous. Then the third issue is on the independence of the Office of the Ombud. Now, I'm very pleased to see that we've changed from after consultation to in consultation. That is a good idea. But I'm still very concerned about the finances of the Ombud office, because obviously you want to kill something, starve it of money. It's very simple. So I'm not suggesting you'd want to do that, but I do think that there needs to be some kind of a thing to make sure that the finances of the Office of the Ombud are not compromised in any way should they start doing things that make SARS uncomfortable. I'm sure they won't, but you never know for the future. And then finally, this was an issue that I raised right from the outset, and it is a difficult issue because I don't know what the solution is, but we need to think about it. Whistleblowers report things to SARS about problems that they find out there. So they say, there's something irregular going on, tax is not getting paid, etc. And then they tell SARS. SARS then investigates this, hopefully, and then reach a conclusion and something happens. But we don't ever know whether you have or haven't. Now, I'm not saying that we want to know individual cases of what you're doing on that, but I think it's important for us to know that there is some kind of action, because that's what Parliament does. We have oversight over SARS. So we need to make sure that you're actually doing that thing. And I think we need to think about it because this is the Tax Administration Bill. And that's all for now. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is about the inspection. What would SARS do, limited inspection, what would SARS do in the events where they've gotten information that an unidentified business premises has been, the document or things have been done in a premises that is not a business area? Will they go and deal with that issue, since here you only specify that it will be only business premises?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to add what Dr. George said, I think we must accept this is comprehensive part of legislation or piece of legislation. And I just want to know, in the opinion of SARS, in the back of your mind, are you thinking of passing or requesting Parliament to pass this legislation this year? I just need to know whether we're in such a rush. And then can I just refer to this document, firstly on page 3, where there was a request to put in that SARS must act reasonably. Now, you don't want to add those words and say they in the Constitution and they in the and PAJA and all the other stuff, you know. But we should move into a phase where we draft legislation. When you read it, it's understandable for those working with it. Why are you so eager not to put the word reasonable in here and say it goes without saying? It is already there. If it's already there, put it in. Why should we not put it in? And then on page 7, where you say it's not accepted to more clearly define a senior SARS official. Now, my concern here is in your own last paragraph, where you say it is not in itself a ground for review. So I'm concerned that SARS is not prepared to clearly defined a SARS official in such a way that we understand what's the meaning of that. Is it a senior SARS official? What is a senior SARS official? So I would like a better reason for that. And then just on the tax ombud, you're making the statement here that it is clearly in line with international practice. We don't know that. You know, there's no ways that on this piece of legislation, this committee can simply become a rubber stamp. Then we are not doing our job.
Thank you. Over to you, Commissioner, and your team.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks to the honourable members for the questions. Chair, let me start with Honourable Korenhoff's question of, are we in a hurry to pass this bill this year? I think, Chair, as you know, most of the provisions, and we did mention it, that almost 80% or 90% of the provisions are all in different acts. that we are regulating and are responsible for at the present moment. So we have consolidated all those provisions, and we have asked for extra provisions in order to make sure that we can execute our mandate as per, you know, the act that has mandated us. So it is in our interest, and I think in the interest of promoting compliance, that we try and finalize this bill as soon as possible so that we can continue to do our work unencumbered and with the fresh mandate that this bill gives us. So we will really wish to persuade, you know, the committee to try and finalize this bill this year. As much as it is comprehensive, we think we are prepared to really unleash as much effort and resources as possible to help the committee to process this thing as soon as possible. But our desire is that if it can be finalized this year, Mr. Kwerenoff. The issues of defining the SARS senior officials and so on, and their ranks and the delegations that are there, I leave it to some of those questions that you asked, Mr. Honorable Kwerenoff, to my colleagues here. So let me start first with the question of the tax ombuds that was raised by Honorable Van Rooyen. Chair, on the mandate of the tax ombud, we got to be clear that there are limitations to the authority of the ombuds. The ombud is not adjudicating on tax disputes. The ombud is put there to make sure that the administrative provisions that are in all the acts that we administer are followed, and that SARS treats taxpayers in the correct manner. The complaints that taxpayers put through have been addressed expeditiously. So if you go to the Act, Honorable Van Rooyen, on page 55, on the bill, sorry, if you go to the bill, not the Act, I'm being presumptuous. If you go to the bill, page 55, you'll see on the top the paragraph 16 that the mandate of the tax ombuds is set out there. So why I'm pointing to the mandate of the ombuds, Honorable Van Rooyen, is to say it's restricted to administrative issues, and in that instance we can take reference to the existing, for example, SSMO, although the ombud has a much more extended powers than the existing SSMO. SSMO in operation basically has a contact center where the public can contact the SSMO, and we are anticipating that the ombuds will also have a contact center. And the contact center needs to field all those complaints that have been dealt with within SARS or SARS has failed to deal with. So whoever sits in the contact center of the ombuds needs to understand the escalation processes and how tax products in SARS are administered. So it's not a thing that you learn in a university, for example, because those are administrative operational processes within SARS. There's only one SARS. So in order for you to be familiar with the escalation processes, how many days does it take to resolve a certain query? What are the guidelines in raising an assessment? What procedures do we follow in case selection? You know, what are the rights and duties of a SARS official? What are the delegations within SARS? All those operational processes reside within SARS. And that is why we are saying, for practical reasons, for the ombud to be operational from day one, you know, the people that are already empowered to understand the operation processes of SARS are in SARS. So it is recommended. If there are other people that can be able to get on top of the processes so that they can be able to resolve taxpayers' complaints expeditiously, then of course the ambush is independent enough to recruit those particular people. But we're just recommending. It's a global practice where even in the U.S. I was there where I met the tax advocate, and he says, look, it's actually illogical for her, it's a her in this case, for her to go and recruit outside, because her competence is not really to adjudicate tax disputes. There are courts and the tax courts to do that. It's really when the IRS has failed to, you know, resolve administrative queries of taxpayers. So the instance of the ombuds, you know, choosing the people is really that. They will decide who comes and works for them, how much they pay, and so on. So let me go straight also to then the finance part of it, because I think Honorable Dr. George asked whether, because the budget of the tax ombuds is appropriated via the National Treasury vote, so ipso facto the SAS budget. It's really that. If at any stage we're going to staff the ombuds money, Chair, the ombuds will report on it. And since the report has been tabled in Parliament, then the ombuds will say, look, you know, they're squeezing me. I've asked for this budget. This is the reason. And there are guidelines, as you know, for every budget appropriation that we have. I mean, we in SAS, at other instances, we might think that the National Treasury is not giving us enough money. But there are guidelines, Honorable George, on how this money has been allocated, what the priorities are. We have strategic plans. We have things that go through this committee. And once those are approved, then they need those objectives and outcomes needs to be financed appropriately based on the priorities of the organization at a point in time. So if at any stage we staff them the finance, they will come straight to you and say, these people are squeezing us and rendering us ineffective. It's not in our interest, by the way, to have an ineffective ombuds. I think it will keep us sharp, it will keep us improving all the time, and it's a necessary tension that I think we need to create in order for us as an administration to become better. So we want to actually even give them more money to do this, those things. On the technology side, we are sharing and, you know, we'll pass the cost through without having to do any margins on the infrastructure that they are going to use. So, you know, we'll try as much as possible to empower the ombuds to be operational. And then, and I think the legal profession, Honorable Matt Lamine has said he agrees that it's the right way to go. And then I think I've also answered then Matt Lamine's question on the secondment side. And then Honorable George asked four questions, of which we've dealt, I think, with the ombuds. Let me talk to the constitutionality and the need for balance. For example, if you know, there are, the regularity of search and seizures are so regular that some analysis needs to be done in order to make sure that the causes for the need for the search and seizure, you know, is reported back to. I think we'll consider that, Honorable George, and it's the right thing to do to analyze how we do our job, what the compliance environment entails, and come back and understand and explain those in a more, you know, understandable way. So we'll definitely take that and make sure that the trends of the search and seizures, where they happen, you know, what type of search and seizures, what kind of people are getting searched and their documents seized. I think we will have to, in our report back to Parliament in terms of our performance report. We report a lot on many issues of enforcement, for example, you know, how many cigarettes, how many drugs, how many whatever we seize, So this will just be one of those. But I think what the Honorable George is asking for is to say on reporting there must be an intelligent analysis of exactly what the manifesting trends and things are on those things, and we take heed of that, and I think it's a good thing to look forward to. And then my colleagues will look at the, they will talk about the protection of the whistleblowers within SARS, the report back of other people that report all sorts of perceived or tax transgressions that are happening. So we receive, on average, I think 60,000 anonymous tips from the public. We categorize these anonymous tips. And as I said the last time, Chair, we have a very strict way that we select cases. There are many ways that we select cases. Firstly, it's based on the level of non-compliance in that particular segment of taxpayers. For example, Chair, there are high net worth individuals, for example, where we look for some form of non-compliance. So if a whistleblower or somebody tips us and say, here is a high net worth individual who is not tax compliant, because it's a priority that we have chosen, we have ways that we go about to select the case. We don't necessarily investigate each and every case that gets reported to us. We don't. We will not have the capacity to do that. Chair, we only are able to do deep audits, 3% of deep audits. We have assessments that we have to do to the tune of 12 million that we have to do. Last year, we managed to do 160,000 deep audits. Those are audits where you take individuals and you do a really full audit. We don't have the capacity to do more than that. Around the world, the percentage guidance is around 1%. We're already doing 3% of it. So in choosing the cases that you are going to dedicate resources to particularly audit, they must be informed by the level of compliance in that particular segment of taxpayers. And as I've made an example of high net individuals, and high net individuals also have segments within them. Like, for example, we did report, Chair, publicly, that there are close to, I think it was 50 or so, no, 150 or so people, sorry, you know, that have aeroplanes, you know, and on an average, you know, they have properties that are worth 10 million or so, and they are only declaring on average 500,000 rand a year. So if somebody comes to us, Chair, and say, you know, I got divorced yesterday, and my husband used to hide money under the mattress and not declare it. And then we have a priority and a case selection mechanism to go after these 150 people. We will go after the 150 people. So that's the first case when it comes to how do we deal with the issue of all these anonymous tips that we get. We don't necessarily follow. Now let me deal with the issue of owing either Parliament or individuals that report these things to us feedback. Chair, Section 4 of the Act that we administer is very clear. There is no provision that says we should come to Parliament and tell them that Parliament has asked us to investigate Obama Khashula. So for that reason, Section 4 has given us provision to come back to Parliament and say, this is how we have investigated Obama Khashula, and this is the level of non-compliance. Chair, there is no provision that gives us that latitude to do that, and we cannot do that. You can imagine, Chair, that if that happens, if we own anybody, including the President of South Africa, any feedback, Chair, we will be opening ourselves to be used for other interests of others. And Section 4 has been crafted quite carefully to make sure that taxpayer confidentiality is paramount. Chair, you cannot run a tax administration without taxpayer confidentiality. If taxpayers in this country ever believe that their information is not in credible hands, that their information can be used for any other reason that we don't understand, then we are going to see the levels of non-compliance actually increasing. So, Chair, it's a sacrosanct. It's a very important principle that I wish to persuade this committee to help us to really keep it intact. If that gets compromised, Chair, it's the end of taxpayers in this country really believing that South African Revenue Service is an institution that has integrity, is an institution that takes taxpayer confidentiality very seriously. It takes one case, Chair, for us to get compromised. And I'm asking to say, even if you want feedback as Parliament, really just remember at what cost, and are we prepared as a country to live within it? There is nowhere across the whole world where, you know, an administration, a tax administration, owes anybody any feedback about a taxpayer. Taxpayer relationship with SARS is a confidential issue that starts and ends with us. And that was, Chair, I cannot talk stronger than that on that one. So let me give my colleagues, Chair, the opportunity to respond to the rest of the staff.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just one or two additional points on the ombud and on the search and seizure before I deal with the reasonableness issue. On the issue of the ombud, just to add to what Opa said, if one really looks at the mandate of the ombud, the sort of main mandate of the ombud in resolving the issues of service is to resolve it through the concepts of mediation and conciliation. And therefore, it's not just always people with tax skills specifically that you need to work in that office. You need people there who are experienced, as Opa mentioned, who understand the systems, but people who are also skilled in the way of resolving and mediation in the mediation of disputes. In that sense, MenSARS has offered a lot of training also to our internal people, because for a number of years we are running alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, so we're training our people also in giving them skills how through the concept of mediation it is possible to resolve skills. The other point also, as far as the international benchmarking is concerned, I think we are touching on in the more comprehensive document what are happening in Canada, in the USA, in the UK, and as we have mentioned on previous occasions, our model is based almost on a bit of a hybrid between the UK model and the Canadian model. But what is possible, what we can also do for the benefit of the committee, we have actually prepared a sort of a briefing note also on the concept of an ombud that actually goes a little bit beyond what is just in the formal response. So we can make that briefing note also available to the members to give them much more background, and that will be very helpful from a benchmarking point of view to assist them. And there's some comparative reviews on how exactly the Canadian office works, how the U.S. model works, how the U.K. model works, etc. So we can certainly do that as well. On the search and seizure, on the sort of a more sort of balanced approach that one needs to follow there, I think if one can look at the provision itself, I think some of the safeguards that we've really tried to build in there, that the official must at all times, you know,
act on reasonable grounds. There must be an imminent danger that documents will be removed, that the person must be convinced that if we applied for a search and seizure warrant, I mean, that would have been issued to us, that any delays would sort of defeat the object. So I think we built in, or tried to build in, a lot of specific tests in the section itself. And also, as we've mentioned on previous occasions, there's about 17 other pieces of South African legislation that contains a similar provision. But here, once again, I think it's possible we also have a briefing note on this specific topic. I think that might also be helpful. We list, you know, all those other provisions in the different laws, and then what are the arguments for it, etc. The international benchmarking also around that. There's many other jurisdictions who've got similar provisions, revenue authorities like New Zealand, the Australians, etc. So I think even that would be helpful for committee members. If they want it, we can make that briefing note also available. On the issue of reasonableness, I think one must be careful here, because I think it's actually a concept of much wider than what is reasonable. I mean, if you really talk about the concept of any taxpayer's constitutional right to fair administrative justice, that's actually the concept that is at play here. And fair administrative justice is actually a concept that goes much wider than just a test of reasonableness. There are many, many more tests that you will find in the in PAJA and in the case law that has developed over many, many years, that needs to be borne in mind. So, and I mean, concepts like the person should not act in a biased manner, in an unfair manner, with any alternative or ulterior purposes in mind, in bad faith or capriciously. So I think it's a much wider concept than just reasonableness. And the danger that you run into if we in the tax laws are trying to define, you know, what fair administrative justice is, then we run the risk that ultimately we may land up, you know, in conflict, you know, with provisions or with the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, which is an act that governs, you know, administrative justice as far as the whole system is concerned. So I think that's where our concern comes from, that in the end we may be at odds, you know, with experts who actually drafted the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. So I think that's where our concern comes from. And it's therefore an inbuilt issue in any action that any government official needs to take. You must comply with the overall concepts of the constitutional, requirements of fair administrative justice in a much wider sense. I don't know, Franz, maybe if you can deal with the inspection and the SARS official issues. Thank you. Yeah.
All right, thank you. Just on whistleblowers, I think we should all be aware that there is a specific piece of legislation that deals with the protection of whistleblowers. And, as far as SARS internally is concerned, we have a whole internal structure to deal with reporting of problems and potential corruption and so forth. So, we take it seriously internally, and there is other national legislation that deals with the topic. On the question of inspections, remember, this is a very limited inspection. It's merely to check the identity of the person. Are they a taxpayer? And if they're a taxpayer, are they keeping records as they're supposed to? So it's not an investigatory tool. It's just a very brief check. Where you are dealing with somebody who is perhaps running an unauthorized business operation that needs to be audited, that SARS is aware of, then we would probably be talking in the region of a search and a seizure with a warrant. Okay, where SARS arrives unannounced to do an audit. On the question of a SARS official, I think the issue here is that there's a very broad scope of SARS officials, and I may be a senior SARS official for the purposes of legislation and certain areas in dispute resolution, but I should not be a senior SARS official when it comes to audit. I used to be in the audit space, but I haven't been there for many years. My knowledge is probably out of date, and therefore I should not be designated a senior SARS official for that purpose. Given the very broad range of roles that are in SARS, it's going to be really, really difficult to try and come up with specific criteria that you're going to write into the law for each of these. And that is why you'll see, in fact, the last paragraph of the response suggests that what will happen is that SARS will publish the names or designations of the people who are appointed senior SARS officials for various purposes. So at some point in the future, you're either going to see Franz Tomasek listed in that list, or the person who occupies the position of Group Executive Legislative Research and Development is a senior SARS official for the following purposes, ABC, but not for any other purposes. And then that gives taxpayers the opportunity then to say, okay, Mr. Tomasek's written me a letter, okay, he can write me the sort of letter, or he can do the sort of thing. So there's a check and balance built in. Oh, yes. The Commissioner just reminds me that if you're going to go out into the field and knock on people's doors, there is the provision for an identity card, which we're working quite hard to make tamper-resistant and all those other good things that they should be, so that people are certain that the person sitting or standing there in front of them is, in fact, a SARS official.
Okay. I guess there are no follow-ups. Any follow-up, Honourable Members? Yeah. No, I think we are doing well in terms of time. I agree with Honourable Members that this an involved piece of legislation or bill before us. We have received a report back for documentation that was received here, and I think Kosi and Katinka have also indicated that they might put some additional information together in a form of document that will assist the committee when it sits on its own to apply its mind on the responses that we've given. And we also take into consideration the fact that these are a number of, it's a consolidated piece of legislation or bill that seeks to almost regulate various acts in the tax arena. So it is important that the committee applies its mind in such a way that we don't hamstring the ability of SARS to continue to do the good work that they are doing in the country. The other thing that I really wanted to ask, which will be part of our deliberations, you see, on the issue of the Umbas, that document that you're talking about, Kosi, you know, what is your understanding or what should constitute the understanding of the responsibility of that office? It will help us as a committee when we deliberate. Because if we move from different understanding of what the tax ombud is all about, we may actually come to different approaches in terms of how should this office be constituted. However, that doesn't take away what Honorable Van Ren raised. You see, in the mind of an ordinary taxpayer, an ordinary citizen, you don't want to create an impression that their issues could be resolved elsewhere if they've got problems. Either through the public protector and so on and so forth, or the tax courts.
let's create institutions that would be relevant for that particular purpose that we're supposed to focus on. And therefore, the issue of the selection of the staff, you know, Parliament can express its views, but once we have actually made a determination, it will be important that we follow that. We are not going to be involved in interviewing the staff as Parliament. We will not do that. But it is the principle that we need to establish as Parliament, and I think that principle, once the committee has actually deliberated upon, it will be important that SARS applies its mind and probably respect that particular proposal from Parliament's side. On the issue of warrantless search and seizure, of course, one of the things that you cite is that there are other 17 pieces of legislation which are more stricter than what you're proposing. But you also go further to say it will only be used in narrow circumstances. Thirdly, you are also, and we did of course receive a presentation by the legal experts, but that would not necessarily replace the role of the Constitutional Court if somebody. And there's a tendency now in this country, let me put it this way, that the Constitutional Courts have become now a site through which you can test all sorts of pieces of legislation and opinion. Processing of this bill from the executive to the committee to parliament, if the committee accedes to the proposals as they are or certain amendments, it is the president who must assign to this bill before it becomes an act. And he too would have to be satisfied about the constitutionality of this bill before it becomes an act. Where possible, I think we should avoid a situation where everything has to be tested at the level of the Constitutional Court, whether the things that we are saying are doable, are constitutional or not constitutional. So what I'm saying is, in applying our mind as a committee, our minds as a committee, we'll have to look into various areas that will ensure that we don't unnecessarily so continue to create complications within our democratic institutions and systems. So that it is not Parliament or the President that is always challenged, you know, by citizens, and the Constitutional Court becomes the final arbiter on everything. Of course, supposed to do that, to test the law. But I think we should, in fact, I'm asking myself, in your opening remarks, Commissioner, you say the filing system is so efficient that today you almost have 2 million. Is that so? So the question I'm asking myself is, what is the attitude of South Africans towards compliance? Is it improving, or do we see a decline? My sense is South Africans are becoming more and more compliant, and they are becoming more responsive. Now, if you are dealing with selected few cases, we shouldn't pass laws that would actually send a message that there's a generally a crisis out there when there's no crisis in terms of what you're seeking to achieve. And therefore, we need to find a way, how do we strike a balance, because the attitude that you have is the one that says we as South Africans would want to be part and parcel of the rebuilding of this new democracy, and will also play our ball on our side as taxpayers. The piece of legislation that you put in place should actually enhance that a positive development. Shouldn't negate that because we may undermine, you know, a very positive development in society. Indeed, if there are fewer and stricter cases that we are going to deal with, we would want to make sure that even that you do it within the constitutionality aspect of our own democracy. It is very, very, very important. The issue of the definition of a senior SARS official, I think it's important. It's a very, very important matter that you have said it takes only one case to bring doubt into a very good institution, so to say. So if we can be able to avoid such issues, let's find a way to deal with those challenges much earlier. We don't want to cite cases. I mean, we are part of this country. We have seen what has happened. Good intentions undermined. And it's not only in the area of compliance in terms of state institutions. Even if you go into social grants itself, the law is very, very, and the policy is meant to benefit those who really deserve. But you then have few rotten apples who then get into the system and undermine that. So you don't have to scrap the policy because it was few elements that you need to deal with. You have to find a way to deal with a few elements to enhance that particular policy. Having said so, Commissioner and your team, thank you very much for the comprehensive responses and the engagement that we have had with other stakeholders, with whom, as Parliament also, we have had the opportunity to interact with. Clearly, I think the manner in which we evolve our policies is a very, very transparent way. We do it in a very transparent way that everybody is on board. The committee will, on a particular date, on a set date to come, sit and apply its mind on all these presentations. If need be, we'll still interact with you. But we think the committee is going to apply its mind after all these presentations. But I want to emphasize Kosi and Katinka, help us with those inputs that you promised to, or you volunteered to put forward, to submit to the committee. That will help us. Thank you very much, Commissioner. 5 minutes comfort break, not smoke break, just comfort break. And then we come back to take a presentation by one of the revered presenters, Momoy Momiat, Ishmael Momiat.